Washington, this is VOA News. I'm Steve Norman reporting. The Obama administration says it will pause a $500 million Pentagon-led program to train and equip Syrian rebels fighting the Islamic State militants. VOA Pentagon correspondent Carla Babb has details.
The program will shift away from vetting moderate Syrian rebels and plucking them off the battlefield for training. The Pentagon will use a small training center in Turkey to teach these leaders skills, including how to call in airstrikes. Brad McGurk, the White House envoy to the Anti-Islamic State Coalition, says the program will also work to better equip and provide air support to trusted units on the front lines in Syria.
Is it best to take those guys out and put them through training programs for many weeks, or to keep them on the line fighting and to give them additional enablers and support? I think the latter is the right answer, and that's what we're going to be doing.
The train and equip program had only trained a few dozen fighters, much less than the original goal of thousands. Secretary of Defense Ash Carter said Friday he, quote, wasn't happy with the early efforts of the program. Carla Babb, VOA News, the Pentagon.
General Hossein Hamadani, senior Iranian Revolutionary Guards commander, has been killed in Syria. He was advising Syrian troops in the northern region of Aleppo. Shad Iran has provided military and political support for President Bashar al-Assad during his four-year-long fight against a wide range of Sunni rebels, the group seeking to overthrow him. AP is reporting that a mayor says a group of suspected jihadists attacked a village in central Mali, killing a local official in front of his family. Haruna Bellum says the attackers were suspected members of the radical Messina Liberation Movement, which has been blamed for other attacks this year that have targeted military and civilian authorities in south and central Mali. This is VOA News. UN Security Council has authorized additional measures to help its more than 12,000 peacekeepers in South Sudan protect civilians and pressure the warring parties to implement the August 25th peace agreement. VOA's Margaret Bashir has more.
The 15-member council demanded an immediate cessation of all violence as the fragile peace deal continues to suffer violations by both sides. It threatened more sanctions against spoilers to the peace process and those perpetrating attacks against peacekeepers and aid workers. The council urged the Secretary General to complete deployment of the mission, known as UNMISS, to its full strength of 12,500 troops and police, including equipment such as tactical helicopters and unarmed drones to help peacekeepers protect civilians. The decision to use drones in South Sudan has been controversial, with several council members expressing concern about it, including Russia and Venezuela, who abstained in Friday's vote. The government in Juba also strongly opposes the use of drones. The UN has used them in DRC and Mali, saying they are an asset in large, difficult-to-patrol countries with too few troops. Margaret Bashir, VOA News, the United Nations.
The UN Security Council passed a resolution on Friday to authorize the European Union and countries outside the EU to board, search, and seize vessels suspected of human trafficking in the Mediterranean Sea off the coast of Libya. 15-member council adopted the measure drafted by Britain to counter the refugee crisis in Europe. In the past, the EU focused on search and rescue operations in the Mediterranean, but with this year's overwhelming flood of migrants from Syria, Iraq, and other hot spots in the world, thousands have ended up dying at sea trying to reach Europe. Here in the U.S., President Obama met privately on Friday with families of eight students and one instructor gunned down at a community college last week in the state of Oregon. After the family meeting, Mr. Obama said the country will have to figure out how we stop things like this from happening.
You know, I've got some very strong feelings about this because when you talk to these families, you're reminded that this could be happening to your child, or your mom, or your dad, or your relative, or your friend.
A crowd of pro-gun protesters greeted Mr. Obama as he arrived in Oregon to console the families of last week's mass shooting in Roseburg. President Obama has been calling for stronger gun control laws in the aftermath of the shooting. And thousands of people expected in Washington this weekend for the 20th anniversary of the Million Man March. In 1995, the Nation of Islam called for African-American men to come to Washington and pledge to do better as husbands, fathers, and leaders in their communities.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
From Washington, VOA presents Issues in the News.
Welcome to Issues in the News. I'm Fred Barnes of the Weekly Standard, and joining me on the show this week are Hillary Krieger, Enterprise Editor for CNN Politics Digital, and Oren Durrell, Foreign Affairs Reporter for USA Today. And here are the issues. The Trans-Pacific Partnership, the trade treaty among Pacific Rim countries, was finalized, and former U.S. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton announced her opposition to it. She was once a supporter of the treaty. In Brussels, NATO leaders discuss keeping more troops in Afghanistan after 2016, more than the few hundred the Obama administration's plans call for. Meanwhile, Russia expanded its military intervention in Syria amid criticism that the American response has been insufficient. And in Washington, congressional Republicans were in disarray after House Majority Leader Kevin McCarthy decided not to seek the top post, that of House Speaker. Hillary, I'm going to start with you. What about this trade treaty? It passed the first hurdle, which was called fast track, which means amendments cannot be added to it, you know, to amend it to death when it's on the floor of the House and the Senate. And now the treaty has been finalized, and obviously there's one more hurdle, and that's to vote to pass the treaty. I don't know whether I should have been surprised or not to see Hillary Clinton, who said so many good things about this when she was Secretary of State, all of a sudden opposing it, but what about all this?
Well, I think Hillary Clinton has very clearly over the course of this campaign moved to the left when it comes to economic and social issues, and this is very much in keeping with that. You know, the progressive activists are the most vocal, the most engaged. They're the ones turning out in the thousands for Bernie Sanders, you know, previously little known senator from Vermont, who's not even a registered Democrat, who's now, going neck and neck with her in some polls in key states. So she sees that as the biggest threat. And this trade deal is something that animates that group of people. And so she's certainly made a political calculation. I don't think you can really argue that this is about the merits of the deal, of foreign policy considerations, et cetera. For one thing, she was one of the key people involved in the pushing for this.
Yeah.
And she was Secretary of State while a lot of the key negotiations were going on. And I think the question is, who sees her criticizing this deal and will believe that she's really reversed position? It seems so shrewdly political that it's hard to see the progressives thinking that this is really a newfound belief that she has. But at the same time, the countries and people in Congress who are moderates who need to know that they're going to be able to see this through, you know, it has to jitter them a little bit, though she certainly left herself some wiggle room in terms of talking about the deal in its current standing. She doesn't know all the details. She gave herself some room to come around to it in the end if she were actually president.
Okay. Well, certainly the Washington Post in its editorial, Oren, agrees with what Hillary said. They describe her decision as transparently political. But in any case, what about the treaty more broadly? And, you know, one of the fears now is that with people like Hillary Clinton against it, that it won't pass. I mean, normally, once you pass fast track, that means you can get the treaty passed. I'm not so sure on this one.
This deal would be one of the last major accomplishments of the Obama administration. And in a Republican-held Congress, I think that this deal was facing a difficult time to begin with, even without Hillary jumping on the bandwagon against it. You know, she's saying that, you know, basically the labor unions are against the deal. Business interests are, which together with the Republicans, they're very much in favor of this deal because they think it's going to increase business.
There are a lot of Republicans against it.
But there are a lot of Republicans against it, too. So it's hard to say what the prospects are of this deal.
What would the repercussions be if this deal is defeated? I mean, countries involved here are not small ones necessarily. It's Australia, it's Canada, it's Japan.
You know, this deal is seen as a project that would increase economic growth for the United States and also increase access to the American markets for countries like Vietnam and Japan and Australia. Other countries like South Korea also want in on this deal. China is doing what it is not part of the deal, but is it would definitely try to take advantage of its failure if it fails. They're going to try to woo some of those countries and woo those businesses to China and to try to cut deals with them.
Hillary, what about that? What would be the fallout if this failed? I mean, this has been under negotiation, I don't know how many years, but many.
Right, and I think in addition to the genuine economic interests involved, this is a real cornerstone of President Obama's legacy and mm-hmm. his effort to so-called pivot to Asia, again, a policy that Hillary Clinton was once deeply involved with.
She was.
And the idea was, you know, to say that the U.S. recognizes that Asia is really where the future is right now, to see that China not be the only dominant power. It aspires to be a superpower. The U.S. mm-hmm. wants to show its allies like Japan and South Korea that it too is going to be a major force, and bringing all these different countries together, which is a gargantuan task, largest trade deal ever in history, 40% of the world's economy, shows that the U.S. does have real leadership in this region and mm-hmm. really can be something of a counterbalance to China, and it can do it in a peaceful way. So to not have this happen, because of domestic American politics, I mean, they were able to put all those jigsaw pieces together of this diverse group of major countries, really shows weakness for Obama. But, you know, he's on his way out anyway. It really shows failing of the American political system. Mm-hmm. And the fact that the U.S. wants to be an international leader but can't get its own house in order, which goes to the chaos we saw in the Republican Party mm-hmm. in trying to elect it just, you know, ahead of its own faction.
Yeah.
I think it would be very damaging to U.S. standing, and it would really call into question what the U.S. can deal with in mm-hmm. the future. You know, they had to get countries to make a lot of concessions that mm-hmm. they didn't want to make because of how they would look for their domestic mm-hmm. audiences. And if the U.S. asks for those concessions, puts them in a vulnerable position, and then doesn't deliver itself, I think that that's really going to be damaging to the U.S. Internationally.
You know, I can remember when we had a free trade majority in this country, in Congress especially. Oren, you can probably remember that too. And Hillary's a little younger. She may not remember this, but it started to turn, I think, really in 1993 when the president was Bill Clinton, and it was the North American Free Trade Agreement. And he lost a majority of Democrats. Of course, he's a Democrat in Congress, but Republicans supported it. And since then, as we talked about earlier, Oren, the Republican huge majority in favor of free trade doesn't exist anymore. So you have Democrats who are against free trade and Republicans who have moved against it, and you have a treaty in jeopardy.
Right. That's the political situation that, like Hillary said, that this treaty is facing. And, you know, I guess we'll have to see what happens.
All right. Let's take a short break. We'll be right back with more Issues in the News.
News happens around the clock. And VOA brings you the latest at the top of each hour.
This is Joe Palca.
I'm Victor Beatty.
Francis Alonso.
Tune in for a summary of the news at the top of each hour, around the clock on The Voice of America. Hourly newscasts on the radio and on the internet at voanews.com. VOA, a leader in news coverage for over 70 years.
Welcome back to Issues in the News on VOA. I'm Fred Barnes with Hillary Krieger and Oren Durrell. Let's turn to Afghanistan, which is increasingly worrisome. I'll start with you, Hillary. There is talk now, including by the American Defense Secretary, Ashton Carter, at NATO, about leaving more troops than the Obama administration has originally called for. It seems to me it's unavoidable.
Well, I think that Obama has been very committed to not getting U.S. troops involved in places he doesn't want to. So I think if he's truly committed, he might pull them out, regardless of the situation on the ground. Mm-hmm. But, you know, it depends what the U.S. is willing to settle for, you know. And again, if it's sort of get American troops out at all costs, let Obama keep a promise to end both wars, you know, Afghanistan and Iraq, mm-hmm. by the time he leaves the office at the end of next year. And if that becomes the grand imperative, and there's a lot of messaging that goes out that similar to Iraq, that we have to leave this to the people in Afghanistan. It's, you know, their issue right now. You know, the terror threat is much lesser than the threat of the Taliban and their mm-hmm. challenge to the central government there. And the idea that enough American lives have been lost and et cetera. I think you can see that messaging happening, and I think you can see the Americans leaving. I think the military, though, is not as pleased to do that. They've invested a lot there, and they've been trying to work with the Afghan military to have them take over missions and things like that. And as they've faltered, there's a desire to continue to see that part of the mission through. And because the central government now in Afghanistan has a new leader who's much more positive towards the United States and really is very concerned about what happens and the ability of his government to keep out the Taliban once American troops leave, he's been able to work better with the American military, mm-hmm. with the American government, and that creates a bit of a different dynamic, which makes it more possible to see that there could be an agreement to keep forces there.
Oren, we have one of these situations where the American military has been publicly candid about wanting to keep more troops in Afghanistan than the 1,000 or fewer the administration in Washington would like to have remain there.
I think obviously there are a lot of elements that play into that. And one of them is that the peace talks with the Taliban have not really been going as well as I think the American administration had hoped that they might. And in fact, the fighting continues, and we've had this fighting in Kunduz, a city that the Taliban took over for a few days. And in taking it back, there was this disaster where the American airstrikes hit a hospital in Kunduz and killed, I think, 22 people that with the Médecins Sans Frontières, the Doctors Without Borders. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that creates, this week we're dealing the White House is dealing with another crisis there. But the issue is that the fighting continues, the political reconciliation that they've been trying to reach has not really gotten very far. And the U.S. military is really cognizant of the results of pulling out of Iraq and how that sort of situation kind of deteriorated after they left. And I'm pretty sure that they don't want to repeat that mistake there.
No, I'm pretty sure they don't. But President Obama has never made the point or conceded the point. Republicans have made the point that pulling out of Iraq, all the troops at the end there really allowed the collapse. It wasn't entirely the president's fault, but it made the situation worse. And now we have ISIS in Iraq. Well, I'm going to turn to, I've sort of backed into Syria, which is a bit of a hotter issue than either Afghanistan or the Trans-Pacific Partnership Trade Treaty. You know, I'll have to say, I've been in journalism a long time, but I'm still surprised, you know, to read that the Russians are firing missiles from ships in the Caspian Sea into Syria. I thought that was just another escalation that is surprising. Hillary, maybe you weren't surprised. Maybe you're jaded.
That's right. I mean, that's the thing. Putin has pulled off so many surprises that now is sort of the expected on some level. But of course, the aggression and the extent to which he has put himself into the conflict in Syria certainly was not something that the United States was assessing. There are actually some in Congress who were criticizing the U.S. intelligence services for not anticipating this, that they were taken so much by surprise. I kind of think that's a little bit unfair because who can fathom what Vladimir Putin's going to do next? Yeah. But he certainly has taken a position of no holds barred. He says that he's doing this in order to wipe out ISIS, which is a mutual enemy with the United States. But the targeting, according to the State Department, 90% of Russian strikes have been on non-ISIS related targets. So I think that, you know, when Putin decides to do something, he doesn't feel the constraints that the Americans might feel going into a place like Syria. He's playing to win. He wants to make sure that his impact is felt. He wants to show the U.S. that he's going to do what he wants to do. And in fact, what we've seen are now Russian planes that are flying in the skies, not a big area, that coming very close to American planes. There haven't been talks to figure out sort of the MO of how these planes interact with each other. So American planes, in, you know, a couple of cases now have actually backed off. The U.S. isn't willing to take him on there. And so he sees an opening, and he's pressing it wherever he can.
Oren?
Putin's strategy is to confuse and literally delude the West and the Americans and to keep them off balance. These strikes from the Caspian Sea are a very showy demonstration of ability of what he's capable of. His approach to the rebels and to the fight on the ground in Syria is aimed at eliminating the middle ground between President Assad and ISIS, basically following the playbook that he used in Chechnya and that he tried to use in Afghanistan, where he went were not he, but were the Russians and the Soviets went after the moderate opposition to them in those two places, and left the local population with a choice between radical Islamists and an authoritarian regime. That's the policy that he's helped President Bashar Assad of Syria to pursue in Syria. And when American-backed rebel groups with American TOW missiles started attacking and destroying Syrian tanks, that's basically when Putin came in with his air force and is starting to backstop Assad.
Let me stop you right there. I need to take a break, and we'll be right back with more issues in the news.
VOA podcasts are a convenient way to get your information on the run.
VOANews.com.
Visit VOANews.com and click on podcasts to learn how you can subscribe.
Welcome back. I'm Fred Barnes with Orrin Durrell and Hillary Krieger. I think, Orrin, I interrupt you in mid-sentence. If you want something to add here, go right ahead.
Only that what's not clear about what Putin is doing is how far he will go and whether he'll be successful. And a lot of that will depend on what his opponents do in Syria. The Saudis are saying that they see an escalation of support to the moderate rebels, and it's not clear exactly. President Obama is saying that the United States is not interested in getting into a proxy war with Russia in Syria, but I think it's still unclear how far that's going to go.
Hillary, whatever we think about Putin, at least my view is he's been pretty successful so far, even with this escalation. As you noted, you know, the Americans have sort of gotten out of the way so there won't be any incidents in the air with Russian planes. And so it goes. There's been an attack in the Washington Post, a pretty strong piece by former Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice and former Defense Secretary Gates, who was not only George W. Bush's Secretary of Defense, but also President Obama's. Highly critical piece of the stance that the president has taken.
Right. I mean, the president has basically said that this is not going to change his calculation on Syria. And the messaging that's been coming out of the administration is, we haven't had such an easy go in Syria, and Putin won't either, that this is going to be a quagmire. That was the word Obama used at a recent press conference. And they are seeing this as a place where Putin overplays his hand. He's going to anger a lot of Syrians on the ground, these non-ISIS sites that have been targeted. Mm-hmm. People are pretty angry there. The Saudis are being provoked to step up their support, et cetera. And that he will regret this and that this will really weaken him. I think that there is some chance that that happens, but it also could be wishful thinking. So it really takes the United States out of a position of determining and trying to shape events and hoping that Putin succumbs the way the U.S. could. But again, the U.S. has other domestic constraints that Putin does not face. So it's really a gamble on the part of the U.S.
Orrin?
I would like to add that you mentioned that Putin seems to have been successful so far.
Yeah.
He's been successful at surprising us. When it comes to his efforts on the ground, his effort in Ukraine actually was not that much of a success. And he's turning from that to Syria, in part to take away attention. The world is not paying so much attention to Ukraine anymore. But what's happening there is that the ceasefire that's taken effect, and the Russian efforts there were not nearly as successful as they thought they would be.
Mm-hmm.
So we'll see what happens in Syria.
Okay, we're going to turn to Republicans in Congress. They control both the House and the Senate. And there's, at least on the House side, where Republicans have 247 members, a group of about 40 of the most conservative ones seem to be the tail wagging the dog, to use an old cliche. And what happened in particular was that John Boehner, the House Speaker, the number one guy in Congress, in the House anyway, has said he's going to step down. The expected replacement for him was Majority Leader Kevin McCarthy of California. And now he has said he's not running, apparently because he didn't have the votes on the House floor where both Democrats and Republicans vote. You would need a majority, 218, and he didn't seem to be able to get there. And who knows now what's going to happen, who the speaker will be, what's going to happen among Republicans. What about this seeming chaos in Congress involving Republicans?
Right. Well, it's funny, you know, Boehner and McCarthy's messaging has been that they want unity in the in the party, and this has certainly moved anything, you know, far from that position. It's, you know, empowered what is a minority faction within the Republicans, a much more extreme conservative group. But, you know, they've been pushing for this and they've been able to sort of fell these giants. So if anything, it emboldens that group. And it also really raises questions about a Republican's ability to govern going forward. It's not that there are sort of just two competing ideas within the Republican Party on different issues. It's about how you govern at all. And this group of conservatives wants the Republicans to take a much more oppositional line. They consider compromise a dirty word. It's very hard to govern in Washington if you don't compromise. The way the entire American system was set up is that you have competing branches so that you form compromises. Mm-hmm. And if you look, you know, more broadly right now, the Republican Party is having a big debate within itself among primary voters about who they're going to put up as their next president. And you see the groups, the people that are, you know, resonating with this same, this more extreme faction within Republicans in Washington doing well at the polls right now. And there's a real question about the type of leadership that Republicans want and how that then translates into leadership for the American people, who tend to be much more moderate on the whole than this group, who do want to see some ability to legislate. And I think that it's going to be very damaging for the Republican Party, not just in terms of its own ability to get business done and make decisions within itself, but really how the American people perceive the party itself.
You know, Orrin, one of the things that hasn't changed, you may get a new speaker. We don't know who it might be. I mean, there will be another one selected. It's required. You do need to have a House speaker for the things to move ahead. But what hasn't changed is the ability of Democrats in the Senate to block through something called the filibuster, to block any legislation that Republicans might want. And then the president, President Obama, can veto it, and they certainly don't have the votes to override his veto. What's your take on the whole thing, this chaos in Congress?
This is an extension of a trend that's been going on for a few years now with this, I think, you know, maybe it started with the Tea Party, maybe earlier, where the Republicans are really trying to find themselves. And I think this really started maybe at the end of the George Bush presidency, where they were losing some support in the American electorate, but also trying to come to terms with what their identity really is and how conservative they really are and where they stand on some of these basic issues. But like Hillary said, I don't think that the very conservative wing of the Republican Party represents a broad spectrum of Americans. So they're trying to find their identity, and as they do so, they seem to be going more and more to the right, which is going to hurt them in the national polls. One of the things that have come up is if the Republicans can't agree on a speaker, then there may have to be some kind of a coalition, a combination of Republicans and Democrats who actually vote together on a speaker. And that speaks to what you're asking about, which is, you know, that might actually lead to actually getting things done in the future.
It might, but it would be, boy, that would be a drastic step for Republicans to, you know, summon Nancy Pelosi, the Democratic leader in the House, to come, hey, help us out. We can't, to help out the most conservative faction, to help out and elect a speaker. You know, one of the odd things about this being a House speaker, it doesn't have to be a member of the House even. I don't think they've ever elected somebody who's not in the House, but even that idea is coming up, which shows you how drastic the situation is. And, you know, many of these very conservative Republicans thought after they won the House in 2010 and the Senate in 2014 that they would really be dominant and moving things. And since 2014, the person in Washington who seems to have done the most and been dominant is President Obama.
I mean, I think he's been doing a lot of stuff, mostly through executive action, mostly through international Congress. And I think there are a lot of things that really could not sit well with the American public in terms of on the Republican side, that there's not an organized, reasonable